Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine. Welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. We bring you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If music, theater, poetry, film, painting, sculpture, performance art, novels, or digital speculative investor frenzy art are your manna from heaven, come on in for a conversation that I'm sure you'll find nourishing to the spirit. And while you're stopping by under our neon sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please kindly leave your reviews, pose your questions, and be part of our community of friends and supporters. And to get more simply wonderful words, images, and sounds, you can pay a visit to our website, www.glenngould.ca. And while you're there, you'll notice the donate button. We are a registered Canadian charity. We appreciate your support. Now, today, we're honored to have as our guest a man who is not only one of the most significant artists alive, but also one of the true voices of conscience for our time. Ai Weiwei has worked in a dazzling array of visual media, from photography to film to sculpture, as well as the construction of massive installations from ready-made objects of every kind. The blog he created from 2005 to 2009 in China has been called one of the greatest works of performance art of all time. His scathing, relentless critiques of the Chinese government's violations of human rights and free expression, and the corruption that led to the death of thousands of children in the 2008 Sichuan earthquake, put him squarely in the regime's crosshairs. This led to a life-threatening beating by police in 2009, house arrest in 2010, an 81-day imprisonment in 2011, and the seizure of his passport, followed by legal harassment. He was finally allowed to leave China in 2015, making his home initially in Germany and more recently in the UK. He has continued to work prolifically with exhibitions and installations all over the world, and he has earned praise for his uncompromisingly honest film documentaries, which have dealt not only with issues of repression in China, but also the kidnapping of students in Mexico, the global refugee crisis, the Hong Kong democracy protests, and in upcoming works, the burning of the Amazon rainforest and the plight of Myanmar's displaced and persecuted Rohingya people. He has also protested the imprisonment and extradition procedures against Julian Assange, which he has called a violation of freedom of the press. In his work, Ai Weiwei combines in equal measures astonishing inventiveness, compassion, a sense of moral outrage, provocative ideas, and courage. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ai Weiwei.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin by speaking a bit about poetry, not visual art, because in some ways your experience with repression begins with that of a very respected Chinese poet, your father. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened and how you first became aware that your father was banished, essentially?
Hi. The year I was born, 1957, my father was criticized as a rightist. That means, with about a 500,000 intellectuals was purged by Communist Party. Even he was being called the revolutionary poet, the poet of the people, and also the poet of the nation. Sometimes they call him, and still he has been sending to re-education labor camps, first at Northeast, then later transferred to Xinjiang, where he spent over maybe 18 years. I spent about 15 years in Xinjiang. And, the location now being criticized to have these camps for Uyghur people. So I grew up there. The time when I grew up, he's not a poet anymore. He's forbidden to write. So he has to clean the public toilets for the very low, very poor village. And there was a 13 of them. And day after day, he's working on that. He never took one day off because otherwise he couldn't handle the next day. So But I still know he's a poet, and he did have some poetry books about his own and all other fellow poets, international poets. And in my mind, poetry is dangerous. Poetry is poisoning. And the poetry is what authoritarian state think it's threatening to their existence. So for me, always think that is a treasure. But of course, we cannot really read poetry anymore. I have to help him to burn all the books together, all together, and page by page, beautiful collections, because this is so dangerous to have those poetry.
That's horrific. And it seems as though your father maintained a sense of solidarity with all the people, the most humble people, the people in the villages. I came across a passage, which I hope you won't mind my reading. It's not very long, from one of his poems, Snow Falling on China's Land, which I found very moving. It's not the whole poem, and I hope the translation doesn't do it too much injustice, but it reads, "I tell you, I am a descendant of the farmhand too. Because of your faces fully carved with pains and wrinkles, I can understand so deeply the hardship of the years of those living on the prairie, and I, not happier than you, lying on the river of time, the waves of bitterness have several times swallowed and engulfed me. Being cast out and imprisoned have deprived me of the best days of my youth, my life too, wan and sallow as your lives. Snow falling on China's land, cold is blocking China." And that's deeply moving verse. It also suggests, in a way, very much the spirit that most of the Chinese people must have felt with the revolution, that, you know, there would be an ennobling of ordinary people. All of that obviously was betrayed first by the anti-rightist movement and then by the Cultural Revolution. And your father had to live through that as well.
Beloved poems by Chinese people. And he wrote it in jail. And that day, I think he told me, right after he's finished this poem, he see his jail window, the snow comes down. So he even think the snow is comes down for him, you know, as a poet. And that was during the Japanese occupation time. And he was only 22, 23 years old.
You've written that many of your own projects have poetic elements. Can you talk a little bit about how your father's example and experience have influenced your own art?
I think if anybody have deeply influenced me, it's my father. And from him, I learned how we deeply rooted in the reality, reflects our true feelings, and speak out relentlessly about the truth and about what comes to our aesthetic and moral judgment. You know, this is what I learned from him. And without thinking about the consequence, and without putting yourself in consideration, but rather to make yourself be as a part of the human society or humanity. So he has been doing that for his lifetime, and he has showed me the way how poetry and art can be the best tool in defending of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Your father's exile, and with it yours and your family's, was presumably intended not just to remove him, but also to inflict disgrace and shame. And yet he seems to have come through that with a tremendous sense of dignity and composure and acceptance. Your own spirit, I think, is more overtly defiant in many ways. Was that something that you consciously chose as a way of developing your own response to repression?
Well, I think I'm lucky when I was very young to see how badly my father has been treated. So I can see how humanity can change in certain circumstances. And, you know, there will be no light to shed on this kind of darkness and inhuman treatment for not just day, but for years. And also, you also prepared to accept that will be your life. You know, still under that kind of condition, my father always with a very open heart and positively thinking about life, not thinking about him as a poet or artist, but thinking about how to live an honest life, you know. So that is the most difficult but most valuable education.
With the death of Mao, your family was allowed to return to Beijing, and in 1978, you enrolled in the Beijing Film Academy, studying animation, interestingly enough. You became a member of a group called the Stars Group, which was part of a newly arising avant-garde movement. Can you tell us a little bit about that and those experiences?
Well, after 1976, the whole family moved back to Beijing, which is the capital of China. And of course, we are not allowed to be in Beijing. You know, China have this kind of resident control. If you come from a different province, it's very serious if you come to Beijing. So he has an excuse because he already lost vision of one of his eye during this very hardship laboring. So the doctor recommended him to go to Beijing to protect the other eye, to say, you are a writer. You know, you still have one eye left, but the condition is deteriorating. So he has the excuse to go to Beijing, you know, which is the capital, have better medical treatment. But that's how our whole family went back. And I have nothing to do. And so one of his old friends, they're all professors, but at that time, university stopped for about 10 years during the whole Cultural Revolution. So those professors has nothing to do. And he see, as a young boy, I also have nothing to do. He said, why don't you start to make drawings? I can teach you. I don't like art. You know, I don't even know what art would function in life. But I really touched by this old man's sincerity and passion. So I started to make drawings just only because I'll have to show him. Because each time he would ask me, show me the new drawings. So that pushed me into making works just for him. You know, I have no idea why this art needed, because the whole China is under the propaganda culture and art. So I don't want to even associate with any of those activities. But the school opened again, university, and that's how I get into the Beijing Film School, because that's the first art institution opened the door. So everybody rushed into it. So I passed the test and I got accepted. And as a cartoon design student, I have no interest in cartoon at all. But my teacher told me I would be the best cartoonist he would ever have. But when I have a chance, I went to United States.
That was in 1981, and you came to America to learn and stayed for almost 12 years. What was that experience like? I mean, it must have been such a shock to your system to experience the artistic openness and the completely uncontrolled creativity of New York. You must have felt like a kid on his first visit to Disneyland.
It is very much so. And, you know, I come from Gobi Desert. Then I relocated myself in New York City, Union Square, and I got enrolled in Parsons School of Design. And that experience was quite a culture shock. From every aspect, whatever I seen and I experienced in those days, I never had any traces or memories in my earlier life. So I was quite excited. And to be in the middle of the stage, living in East Village, and you know, this quite a rough neighborhood, but very colorful, very, you know, full of the artists or poets and musicians. So I at the beginning, I was trying to become an artist, you know, because I don't know what else I would be interested in even. And but that was so difficult. I realized it's not even possible for a foreigner with no money, with very little English, to become someone who can making art to support myself or to be a so-called professional artist. So after a while, I gave up. I become an illegal alien in New York City because I don't register in school anymore. So I made some street art, working in the factory and the framing shops, and I did all kind of physical works and carpentry, and just trying to survive like many, many lower migrants, you know, lower income migrants trying to survive in the big city.
Did you find it a lonely experience? Were there people who befriended you and helped to make you feel welcome? Or was it quite isolating?
I would think it's the city seems very stimulating, but in many ways, I would say it's not a very civilized society. It's quite brutal, actually. It's nothing romantic. It's really about a struggle. And I have a few friends, and you know, in this kind of big city, people, you know, they really values powerful struggle competition. So I don't think it has so much charm in there, except you get a lot of information, you see a lot of competition, and yeah, that's how I feel.
One of the people you did meet there was the great poet Allen Ginsberg. How did that come about?
Well, I attend all those poetry readings, and this old guy comes up. I don't know him at the time. And, you know, he was very respectful in this poetry reading called St. Mark's, like Christmas or New Year's reading, you know, a church. And I see all the young people are very, audience, I respect them very much. And he started to read the poetry, and the poetry is about China. He just went after a trip visiting China, and then I listened to it, and there's a paragraph is talking about my father. He said he met an old poet in China because in his writing he has to be sent to Xinjiang for the labor camps, such and such. So when he comes down to the audience, I talked to him. I said that, you know, you just mentioned in your poetry that man, that poet is my father. So he was shocked. He said, well, you know, your father is the only man give me a welcome, very warm hug in China. Because in China, normally people don't hug people, they shake hands. So, you know, we become friends. We become very close.
During that time, you also were exposed to many of the influential contemporary artists in the West, especially in the States. Andy Warhol, of course, was in many ways a dominant figure for many years in New York. But I understand that you also became fascinated with Marcel Duchamp. And in some ways, I see more connections in your art to Duchamp and his ideas, his embrace of ready-made objects, and, you know, his insistence on art that is for the mind, not only for the eyes. Was that a very powerful influence in your thinking, and how did you become aware of his work?
I think Monsieur Duchamp is the man liberating my mind, because he's the artist openly discussed his influence is come from poetry rather than the art scene. And he is the one opened the door for everyone. And he simply destroyed the myth of the art, but rather to put it once again and under the function of the mind. So he's so intelligent and super intelligent. I still can't see anybody who, as those so-called contemporaries, can have a stronger influence than him.
One of the other things I read that you came away from your American experience with was a love of blackjack, that you became quite a proficient blackjack player. Is that right?
Well, if you don't have a regular job and you live in a city which is crazy, it's really about money, power, beauty, and, you know, it's so abstract. And then there's nothing else, you know, it's not so much other sense. So I worked as a street photographer to film, you know, the struggle of the local people, the riot, the also, you know, anti-war movement, you know, and also some kind of black community who fights for injustice. You still have a lot of time. So once I was with a friend at Atlantic City, which is about 2 hours away from New York City, and sitting there just watching them play. And gradually because you have to waste all those time. So I started to play. I think it's a game. And I need a lot of concentration and discipline. And, you know, once I start something, I got totally involved. I was totally attracted. So, and, you know, the casino have to pick me up with a limousine from you know, a huge limousine after sitting there by myself. It's too big for me. And also they opened those luxury hotel rooms, which was, you know, all those French dinner table prepared. But I just nailed myself on blackjack table. I would never touch those pillows and or dishes. Yes. And, you know, it was a funny time, funny moment.
It does sound like a pretty bizarre contrast from the rather tough life that you were living.
It's more tough than the previous life if you play blackjack. You know, I played in many, many, almost every, and also I played in Donald Trump's, you know, the Taj Mahal, and you know, I even have a photo for that one, and you know, it's just such a strange moment in the life.
Well, sometimes truth is stranger than anything you could make up. But the time in the States came to an end, and you returned to China in 1993 because your father's health was failing. But that was also a time where there was a short-lived explosion of openness to avant-garde art. Or if it had always been happening under the surface, it seemed to emerge into the public eye. The cultural environment that you returned to, how would you contrast it from the way it was when you left?
Well, many people told me, when we just come back, you know, China made a great change. It's very different. Everything's different. I never had an illusion about China. Before I left, I know China is never going to change. But I already been brave enough to go back. You know, before I told myself I would never go back. And I told myself New York City is the last destination on the earth I would stay. But I broke all those promises. I went back. I spent about 3 years to see my father pass away. And I have nothing to do, you know. I never had an illusion about China. It does change a little bit. You know, you have a lot of road, a lot of cars, and big buildings. And it's very prosperous you can see it develops so fast. But philosophically, morally, or ideology, they never change a bit. You know, they still remain the most rough, most barbarian society, you know. And I sorrow to see, you know, I don't want to even to think that way, so I'm an outsider. I remember my father told me once to say, Wei Wei, this is your home. Just do whatever you think you want to do. I would say he with his sharpness, he realized my mind is not settled. Even my, you know, I'm there, but I'm not there same time. So I pick up to collecting antiquity, because that time an antique market is booming. And with very little money, you can really buy shocking materials, which for me is a learning of the past, because when I grew up, those materials need to be destroyed, mm-hmm. you know. Our history need to be destroyed, and our memory also need to be destroyed. So for me, it's kind of healing process to see, wow, this is from 2,000, 3,000 years ago. You know, there's a people who are so intelligent, capable, and have such a strong beliefs. And, you know, all those things are very impressive, much more impressive than contemporary art practice for me. So I spent about 6 years doing that till my mom said, Wei Wei, you're so wasting your life. You achieve nothing in your life, and you're wasting all the time. So basically she kicked me out. I was living with her, you know. I was going to live with her to waste my life there, because I was happy, you know. She can, you know, can provide us 3 meals a day, you know. We have a mate, and she's, you know, my family regained the how to say honor, and you know, they're living in pretty nice condition compared to other Chinese. They have a little courtyard. And I was comfortable with a very little room, which is about maybe 12 square meter, which is enough. But I spent time in antique market and bring back some vases and jades. My mom says, Wei Wei, you know, I'm so jealous. You pay so much attention to those old artifacts. I really wish I am the one in your hands, you know. So... But anyhow, I have to move out. I have to make the story a little bit short. So I built my own studio. I said, okay, I move out. By that time, I already published 3 books about Beijing's underground art. You know, well, there's no underground art till I publish those books. So, you know, you need underground books to make underground right. art, because right. there's no galleries, there's no radio, no whatever, you know, even no magazine would write about art. So my books are being so influential, and every artist are secretly passing those. Some even just make a copies of those pages. And I enjoyed it. You know, they call me Godfather from the East Village.
Yes.
Because they really want to know what happens in New York, you know, how Chinese art can become successful, or how West understand us. You know, I told them, forget about those. You know, you just have to pay attention to your real life. The artist in the West doesn't have this kind of experience as you have. You have to treasure it. So, you know, I promote most art in that time, about a generation, whole generation of artists come up. And they are very active till today, and they become quite well-known. And I built my studio. And because of the act, my studio is not a legal building. It's just I rent the farmer's land and build it. You know, in China, this is very common. you know, as long as they not come to knock on your door to say, hey, get out, you know, we need the land. So they license farmers to rent out their land. Actually, the land doesn't belong to them either. So I built my studio, and the studio are so different from any other buildings they're promoting. They are promoting classic Renaissance buildings, you know, to selling for the market. So my aesthetic, minimal, simple, you know, conceptual. And right. Those concepts I have to explain to all those people interested in my building. I become a spokesperson of the new lifestyle in all the fashion magazines and the architecture magazines. Everybody forget I was an artist. And I always enjoy it. And until one day I was, you know, associated with Herzog Dumron, a Swiss architecture firm. We won the Olympic, the competition.
For the bird's nest.
Yes.
Yes. I want to talk about that in a second. But one of the other things, and it's fascinating that you became, in a way, a celebrity. You were a Kardashian in your time. But one of the really important moments was when you co-curated the controversial Fuck Off exhibition in Shanghai, which coincided with the Shanghai Biennale. And it seemed as though you were kind of creating a salon de refusé of your own, or a secession, because you invited 48 avant-garde artists. And it was during that time that, of course, the Dropping Pot triptych was presented, and also your study of perspective, in which you gave the finger to a number of the most revered symbolic buildings in the world. That must have been a moment that felt very liberating, just to call an exhibition Fuck Off, but also to be able to show contempt or to critique the abuse of the past that, you know, Dropping the Vase represented.
Well, I was acting as a very naughty boy, you know, but I don't have audience at all at that time. I just, you know, because something implanted in my genes or my brain, and I act the way I act. I have such a sense of a liberated moment, but you don't know it, you know, until later you realize, oh, that was the moment. So I published books. I made an independent gallery called the China Art Archives and Warehouse. And I made this huge exhibition, probably most memorable, noticeable exhibition called the Fuck Off. In Chinese, the words is non-cooperative art. So non-cooperative art. And in this, a lot of controversial works Chinese people have ever seen. I heard a rumor that the president then, Jiang Zemin, hold this book, the catalog, and to the Central Standing Committee to see, look, the what the contemporary art already deteriorating to that degree. He was very angry. So, you know, it's a lot of nudity and a lot of, violence, or a lot of different things that cannot even accepted by the Western standard. But, you know, as a curator, I believe freedom of speech. I believe art should have the rights to raise questions and to have the rights to expose the controversy, and because art is not just something beautiful. And especially for China, I think there's so many issues need to be talked about. And without being controversy, you cannot even touch those topics.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a head of the BBC in England who did a controversial documentary that involved street gangs, and there was a lot of swearing and violence. And he was asked if he was concerned that people would be offended by this, and his response was, there are some people one would wish to offend. Did you sort of feel that way, that you were openly challenging authorities that were controlling freedom of speech? I'm mindful of the fact that this is after the crushing of the democracy movement and the Tiananmen Square massacre. Did you have a sense of the danger that you might be putting yourself in?
Oh, well, I was not naive. You know, I my father's experience and all what communists did before clearly tell me this is absolutely extremely dangerous. So by 2005, I opened my blog, and at that time they invited me, the CNET blog invited me to see, well, you're so famous, and you're so, you know, they know I'm famous as architect. And also says, so we open a blog for you, for like one-on people blog. And at that time, I never touched a computer before. I don't know how to type. But they said, that's the easy way. It's very easy for you. So they convinced me. I started to write. And once I start to write, I can't stop. It's like play blackjack. You know, I just nailed myself in front of the computer screen and typing every sentence, you know, to say a clear meaning and clear intention, and to see so much response to it. You know, like if I put an article, the next morning would be have 300,000 people have already repasted or posted. So I got so excited. I think, my God, this is the first time we have the rights to have freedom of speech. An individual, yes, in China in this thousands years history, who can do that? Not even king can do that. So I can have my right online every day. So I had this kind of very rocky, you know, exciting time for a few years till 2009. They totally shut off three of my blogs at the same second. So I can suddenly realize how naive I am. But still, I want to expose myself under the spotlight, because I think this is they have to consider if you put yourself under the spotlight, if they do anything to you. So that accelerate my exposure, and only for the safety concern.
Absolutely. And that actually really brings up something that I find very striking, which is two really contradictory things that happened almost at the same time. First was your involvement with the Olympics, serving as artistic consultant for the design of the Bird's Nest. That would be seen as a sign of extreme acceptance in official circles. I mean, you can't get more high profile, and obviously the government had to be involved in choosing who would do that design. But at the same time, I mean, at virtually exactly the same time, there was the horrible earthquake in Sichuan in 2008, and your involvement in the citizen journalism project, effectively, to document and reveal the names of over 5,000 children who were lost because of the official corruption that led to completely unsafe buildings, including the schools. So on the one hand, you were seemingly accepted in the most high official circles with one project. And in the other, of course, you took the steps that led to you becoming an outcast, essentially, and someone who became the target of state repression. Did that strike you as being a very ironic moment?
It is. Life is so ironic. And yes, I think if you write an opera, that would be the moment. You have the most glory possibility to design a national stadium. A still very bright, very strong image, very bold design. But at the same time, I was devastated by the Sichuan earthquake. I did a personal research and organized citizens' organization, you know, investigation to trying to find out who was killed during this earthquake. You know, there's about 80,000 people dead. but among them there's over 5,000 students. And the government never gave you right numbers and information. They would always tell you this is national secret. So yeah. I said, come on, you know. I organized online, so we start to organize young people to went to the earthquake area, which is very remote, you know, poor areas. Go door by door, school by school, knock on the doors, talk to the victim's family. And of course, local police knows what I'm doing because I put everything online. And I put our findings online. The names gradually come from our team and sent to me and their diary. And every day I would put our new findings, you know, 5 names, 10 names, 15 names. And that scared the whole nation. Everybody's watching this guy. He's so popular at one hand and doing something so unthinkable, you know, and become a one-person fight with the bureaucracy of the state. Gradually, we find 5,196 names with their birthday, which school collapsed and, you know, they buried them, and their family's location, phone number, everything. Of course, the team has been arrested about a few dozen times. Police would erase all the findings, but still we managed, you know, it's a long-lasting struggle. That put me into a very deep, dark hole. And later, of course, I had these conflicts with the police and I was beaten and it almost cost my life. Yeah. So, but that is a very dramatic moment. And I think at that time they still don't know what to do with me because first I'm the one come from the revolutionary family. All those leaders in the Communist Party, they become a communist before they become, they read my father's poetry. So they deeply respect my father. But same time, they don't know how to handle this guy come from New York and, you know, spiritually polluted and individual and acted, you know, ruthlessly.
Right.
And, but finally they found how to deal with it. So
just to underscore, the thing about the citizens' project to document these deaths was not the fact that the children had died, but that they had died unnecessarily because official corruption led to building schools out of completely inadequate material. I think they called it the, you know, buildings made out of tofu scum. Yeah. So that really wasn't ideological. It was about exposing corruption, right?
Well, it's about expose whole system, how it would not work. It's about cover up. It's about the corruption. It's about how they don't care about the human lives, but rather just maintain their own so-called stability. And that, you know, you are only learning from your personal involvement. I cannot draw this kind of clear conclusion if I'm not deeply involved. So I have to trust what I've been through. And that, you know, I always take a project as a re-educational project for myself.
Right. It's very interesting that the project and the artwork, Remembering, that followed from it, with the huge exhibition with the thousands of backpacks that appeared in Munich. It expressed so much love and compassion for suffering. The thing that the revolution was supposed to help end that suffering of the masses, and it was you and the work of artists who really became the voice of compassion and humanity. At the same time, you were extremely smart in documenting the repression that was aimed at you, including the beating and the surgery. You suffered a cerebral hemorrhage that almost cost your life, and if they hadn't let you go to Germany, it probably would have. But you documented all of that with photographs and video and so on, and that must have been extremely effective in embarrassing the government over what they had done to you, and again, drawing attention to the cover-up.
Well, the purpose for me is to try to live a full life before understanding what life means to me. So I enjoyed for being that. I don't care, you know, what, you know. I think that's, you can call it romantic, because you don't really measure it by the common standard. And of course, it could be danger, but without danger, there's no romance. So I lived who I am, you know, without. By doing that, I will never find out who I am. So it's a constantly discovery, and put myself under some certain circumstance, which is challenging, and I have to respond to. And, you know, maybe that made it a bit more dramatic for the situation. Mm-hmm. And today, actually, is about 10th day, or less than 10 days, we started with another project about the Sichuan earthquake student, you know, who died in the earthquake. We, on the Clubhouse social media, we organized reading those names from April 4th to May 12th, which is the earthquake day. And day and nights, 39 days, 936 hours, people come up to read those names, you know, 5,196 names. Now it's happening. If you open the Clubhouse, you can see commemoration, and it's reading at this moment. Every day I'm reading, just reading those names. It's like long poetry, probably longest poetry in modern life, 900 hours, and it's going to end on May 12th. So why we are still doing this? Because today we have this opportunity. You know, before we don't have it, people from all over the world, no matter you're in Toronto or in Beijing or in Sichuan or in Portugal, you can come up just to read those names. And, you know, this is fantastic. And it will be the best memory for the people who unfortunately lost their life without, you know, even understand they will be remembered. So all the act is about how to remember the past. We don't remember the past without some very symbolic gesture. You know, we have to have a language and a gesture to carry our memory.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that comes from that project that strikes me, and I think that you revealed, is that authoritarian power demonstrates its vulnerability, its weakness, the fact that it is always fearful of independent voices. The state has intelligence services and military and weapons, and yet they had to devote so many resources to suppressing you. That, I think, shows a certain weakness. But I'm also struck that in more open societies, so-called, like the West, that threat is marginalized simply by letting the artist speak but not taking him as seriously, not treating him as a threat. Is that something that you've noticed?
Thank you for point this out. This is a very important issue. I think in China, of course, in many, many repressing states. And any ideas can be seen as dangerous to so-called stability, and you know, can be seen as a subversive for state power. But in the West, democracy and freedom has been, how do you say, over-popularly stated, but with no meaning, with very little meaning. And I think that is truly dangerous because you encourage to say you are so creative, you have such a freedom. I think that's a misleading because creativity and also freedom only come from struggle. You know, without those kind of mental struggle, without to have the judgment, to have the full view about our life. And, you know, it's no such thing as you have freedom. So I think in the West, in general, because of the media, because of the education, because of the mainstream, and purposely trying to misleading people to say they do have the privilege of being free and being a democratic society, which has been proved is not true.
Your work has sometimes been referred to as part of a global art movement called excessivism, which is a critique of an urge to continue acquiring material goods and to the exclusion of, you know, more important moral and humane values. You wrote a really devastating commentary in the New York Times last year called Capitalism and Culture Side, in which you condemned Western governments and corporations for cooperating with China in the interest of profits and putting the essential qualities of a free society at risk through that relationship. Do you feel that trend is growing and that there is a way through art to help continuing to expose it?
I think we have to look at our time in a larger frame of history. You know, why Western become so prosper, and why China is still making a dramatic move and become more and more powerful and have such a confidence in dealing with West. You know, I call it West. I would say more, you know, so-called civilized society. I think there's several issues need to be mentioned. China will never become like today without the total support of the past generations of the need for United States and the West to really gain more profit. It's just simply profit, you know, because the culture of capitalism can be clearly described as a profit-making culture, you know. So China provided the unthinkable dream, you know, the huge population, poor, want to become, do anything possible to become rich. At least they have been pretend like that. Or it works very well, you know. So for past 30, 40 years, China become the biggest labor market. And now gradually, the West think they can be also biggest consuming market. And so this is amazing. But at the same time, they forget China is a very different society. You know, China become very powerful, but China will not accept the Western values. It's not possible. China is not a lawful society. It doesn't have independent of news or report or free expression or independent judicial system. You know, China is dangerous when it's become so powerful. So West gradually realized that it would be difficult for China to maintain this kind of speed because it will surpass the United States, for sure. That's also too late, because the West cannot cut it off from China. China made it very clearly, I'm in your side, you're also in my side. So you inside me. So now it's really a moment. It's very hard. In Chinese, we have a word. Yes, you can get on a back of a tiger to read the tiger, but how do you get off the tiger?
Exactly. It also reminds me of a little saying or a joke that leftists and union organizers had in the early 20th century in America, which is, the capitalist is so greedy he'll sell you the rope to hang himself with.
Yes, that's Lenin's original sentence. He said, he sells the rope, then once everybody pulls the rope, it will kill it, you know?
Yes. And so, you know, Western businesses and the governments that are, you know, under the influence of their large corporations may not realize that they profit today by the cheap labor, but that may no longer be the case in the future, because they're fueling the economic growth of the businesses as well as the state that will supplant them eventually.
I don't think they realize, even they realize, they cannot even stop, because the Western companies are measured by how much profit they can annually. You know, certainly this is a place easy to do business. There's no regulations, or everything can be green light. I mean, this is heaven for their lifetime. You think those leaders or executives in the big company care about human future? Come on, you know, they only care about the profit.
Right.
And nobody can convince them about the future.
Yes. And of course, the standards of living for large parts of the population in their own countries decline as they are continuing to relentlessly pursue those profits. So it's a very dangerous slope. But I realize that we only have a few minutes left. So I have barely touched on your magnificent installations, so many of them that have now become iconic. I hope you won't take this the wrong way. And, you know, I don't think that you're a complete Duchampian, because at the risk of saying that your work is both thoughtful and retinal, it is incredibly thought-provoking, but also exquisitely beautiful in many cases, and, you know, incredibly moving at a powerful emotional level. You know, works like Sunflower Seeds, or your depiction of yourself in captivity, or the beautiful circle of Han Dynasty chairs. I mean, so many of them are extraordinary. And I'm very struck by the incredible range of media that you work in and the mastery of different materials. Is that a huge learning experience every time, for example, when you create the giant circle, the sculptures of bicycles joined together, to learn how to work in those materials and make them respond expressively?
I try to work as my son, who is 12 years old. I really admire him, because every single line he put on paper is a new experience. Without curiosity and learning, why should I do one extra work? You know, there's no fun to, you know, it's only curiosity and the learning and those obstacles and to see your limit. And, you know, those things are challenging. And yes, I think I'm lucky. I have this authoritarian state, and the Chinese culture is ready-made compared to Duchamp. He would have a man's urinary. But I do have China as my ready-made.
That's very, very, very ironic again. I wanted to touch on your work as a filmmaker, which has really emerged as another major thrust in your work. Although it's been going on for a long time, it seems to be accelerating, and there are more frequent works. And you've made really devastatingly powerful films, you know, with a new film, Coronation, about the outbreak of COVID in Wuhan, and Cockroach, about the resistance and democracy movement in Hong Kong. But also now you're turning to the burning of the Amazon rainforest and the disappearance of students in Mexico, the global refugee crisis. It seems, and don't take this the wrong way, that there isn't a hand out there that you won't bite if they're behaving badly. And I think that's all to the good, because it shows that you're not just singularly focused on one form of repression, but all repressions, and that it's a universal rather than a specific instance. How, from a creative and artistic standpoint, do you distinguish your documentary films from your installations, your photographs, and your other work? There's an element of journalism in it. Do you enjoy that?
Yes, the Chinese secret police told me once that you're not journalist, but you did all journalist's work. You're not lawyer, you did all lawyer's work. And I enjoy that because I'm just like a mad dog. I bite. Mm-hmm. You know, I bite whatever I can bite. So, and, you know, those you're making documentary film is devastating. It's a lot of really, you involve knowledge and history and also emotions and also technical to define your language to make it clearly, you know, the narrative can be shared and can be presented. But of course, you know, that's all I enjoyed. But same time, you realize you're desperate because you cannot even accept by those film festivals. And only that make me so encouraged because all those festivals include the Toronto Film Festival and, you know, Venice and all those festivals, they cannot accept those films because the majority of buyers, the market, is from China. They cannot risk to have this troublemaker to ruin their party. So, you know, but I somehow enjoy it because we have the most powerful films presented, but at the same time, we are dismissed. You know, that only means the whole structure are not going to accept me. So that gave me such a sense of successfulness. I'm not only being pushed away by Chinese authoritarian, but I'm also been pushed away by West mainstream, those very commonly be think is defending freedom of speech, but in reality it's not. It's business.
Yes. And in the response, you're basically exposing the moral bankruptcy of those supposed champions of freedom of speech who will not support your free speech because it will offend a major customer, effectively.
Yes, absolutely. You put it so correct.
And at the same time, your work also exposes a kind of a historic, never-ending tension between the artist and his or her patron. Because today, the major patrons for art exhibitions and galleries and, you know, showings are either large corporations or very wealthy philanthropic individuals. They have to know that as they extend the hand to feed you tomorrow, you may be biting it again tomorrow. I know that you won't compromise for them. So they basically have to either like your work enough that they're prepared to overcome that interest, or they will not support you. Do you experience some of that?
My life will be example to us approve. We both will not change. They will enjoy their glamours and power. I enjoy my individuality as most powerful. I still remember my father once quoted the French poet Apollinaire's poetry to say, you know, I have a pen in my hands. I will not change with Napoleon's sword. You know, so that time gave me such a sense about poetry. You know, this man is so proud of writing and art and arrogant, and no power can destroy him. Nobody tells him what to do. That's our brain. You know, we only had that brain. We have to treasure it, you know, not to let anybody to influence it or to crush it.
I think you've underline the ultimate spiritual power of art and the artist. I love the fact that, you know, perhaps there isn't an obvious comparison, but like Banksy, you are a great critic of the commodification and commercialization of art, and you're always doing something different. I understand you're in the process of directing a production of Puccini's opera Turandot in Rome. What led you to that? That is such a striking departure.
I think in my character, I have a sense of a self-destroyedness there and there. It's true. It's always people would say, well, if you do that, it's not going good for you. I said, only because it's not going to be good for me, I do it. So Yeah, I did many things like that.
Does working with music appeal to you? You've done a couple of music videos.
Yeah, I did the music videos. Thank you for you even know all those details. But only because I'm the first person from the music. I never turned on any music in my lifetime. My life is in silence. And, you know, I grew up in Gobi Desert, underground. And we don't hear anything except some crackers or some birds. There's no music when I'm growing up.
So now you can have all the music you want. By the way, your video parody of Gangnam Style is hilariously funny. And it does show that there's a lot of humor in your work beneath the surface.
Yeah, you have to break through, you know, with this kind of so horrible, horrible situation, and to cheer it up, even if it's just, but still, we need it.
Right, absolutely. Well, you've been very, very kind to share this time with us. Before we end, what should we be looking forward to in the future from your work?
Well, as I mentioned, the Clubhouse project is a 936 hours project. It's a big project about the history happened 13 years ago. And I'm so happy you mentioned that. Give me a chance to talk about that. But I do have another film come up about human relations to animals. And it's something I really want to explore. And also have two exhibitions that will happen in Portugal, June and July. So it's plenty of things keeping me very busy. And I would have my book, my memoir, come up in this November. Thanks, you mentioned so many facts which I all writing in my memoir.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being so open and sharing all of this with us. It's wonderful to be reminded that art isn't just an aesthetic force, but it is a spiritual and moral force that is so powerfully communicated in your work. It's a tremendous example that the artist has a sense of purpose and a responsibility to the people and society around them, and that is very inspiring. So again, thank you so much for sharing this time with us, and I hope we'll have a chance to speak again in the future.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Olivia.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm great. I feel so invigorated by that conversation with Ai Weiwei. He's really an inspiration, isn't he?
He is, and it's such a privilege to be able to speak to him here on the Gold Standard. We were so excited when we heard that he would like to join us.
Oh, it was really a special moment, and I really have to say that he combines all of the best aspects of contemporary art and its experimentalism, its adventurousness, with a very traditional view of the moral and spiritual mission of the artist. I find that really an inspiring synthesis.
Absolutely. I really couldn't have said that better myself, Brian.
I'm wondering if you have some information you want to impart to our gentle listeners.
Yes, of course. If you are enjoying listening to The Gould Standard, you can subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening on Apple Music, we would really appreciate your support by leaving a review and a rating for us. For more from The Gould Standard and the Glenn Gould Foundation, you can follow us across social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. We are everywhere, folks. And of course, as I'm sure you know, we are a registered Canadian charity. And if you go to our website, www.glenngould.ca, you will see a little red donate button there at the top. And if you are so inclined, we would really appreciate your gift to help us continue our programming.
Yes, indeed. Your generous support helps us to keep doing what we do and bringing you these podcasts week after week. And now, what's that? I thought we were in a sound insulated booth, but I hear a distant sound approaching. It's like rolling thunder coming out of the past. What could it be, Olivia?
I believe that's Mr. Edison coming in to join us.
Mr. Edison, would you please be so kind as to play us out?